Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Triumph and tragedy. More than 575,000 Americans lost to COVID. As vaccinations in the U.S. ramp up, we hear about the challenges to getting people to take the shot from the front lines in Texas. Then, when commerce confronts conscience, how taking on forced labor in China creates a backlash against Western brands.
Many companies, if push comes to shove, are going to try to stay in the China market and will probably risk a Western blowback over a blowback in China.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart analyze President Biden's address to the nation and his first 100 days in office. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Starting next Tuesday, the U.S. will restrict travel from India due to the spike in COVID-19 infections there. The move was recommended by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and comes as India recorded a new record daily number of cases, more than 386,000. As aid shipments from the U.S. and other countries arrive, several states in India ran out of vaccines a day before the country is set to expand vaccination efforts.
We are requesting the people of Karnataka, especially those who are above 18 years up to 44 years, to refrain from going to the hospitals thinking that you may be vaccinated tomorrow.
Meanwhile, Brazil's health minister appealed to other countries to share spare vaccines as they struggle to pick up the pace of inoculations. The virus has now claimed the lives of more than 401,000 Brazilians. The number of fully vaccinated Americans has now topped 100 million. A decline in new infections has prompted a wider loosening of restrictions. In Southern California, Disneyland reopened after a 13-month closure. The head of the CDC said more reopenings could be possible by midsummer.
We're focused on getting people vaccinated and decreasing the case rates. You know, if we can continue at this pace, case rates are coming down, vaccinations going up, then I think July 1 would be a reasonable target.
We'll have more on the U.S. vaccination effort right after the news summary. Also today, the U.S. Transportation Security Administration extended a mask mandate for travelers on planes, trains, and buses through September 13th. Israel is reeling tonight after a stampede at a massive religious festival left at least 45 people dead and about 150 others injured. Lindsay Hilsum of Independent Television News has our report.
It was the first major religious gathering in Israel since the lifting of COVID restrictions. Some 100,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews were praying and dancing when suddenly it became clear that something was wrong. An urgent announcement on the sound system. Please clear the area. Get out of here. Hundreds had crowded down a tunnel leading to an exit. Scenes from just before panic set in show how constricted it was. Then some slipped, others fell on top. Men tried to get out through the gaps in the corrugated iron sheets that formed the walls. Rescue workers struggled to reach the injured. It's been alleged that the police had cut off key exits. It was desperate. Most of the dead and injured were men, but children had also been crushed. Paramedics took in stretchers for those who couldn't move. Those with broken bones will survive, but many died from asphyxiation or were trampled to death. Many in this community mistrust the government, so are inclined to blame the authorities, not the organizers.
The officers over there couldn't care less. And when thousands of people didn't know in the back of the line what was doing, pushing and shoving happened, and the Israeli government is responsible.
Prime Minister Netanyahu arrived to give condolences. He allowed the Lag BaOmer celebration at Mount Meron to go ahead against the advice of health officials, hoping to attract the support of ultra-Orthodox parties.
The Mount Meron disaster is one of the worst disasters that has befallen the state of Israel. We mourn the victims. Our hearts go out to the families.
Today, they rushed to bury the dead before sunset ushered in the Sabbath. The government has called for a national day of mourning on Sunday.
That report from Lindsay Hilsum of Independent Television News. President Biden spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to offer condolences and assistance. The U.S. State Department said multiple Americans were among the casualties. A car bomb in Afghanistan killed at least 30 people and wounded as many as 90 others today. The attack happened in the capital of eastern Logar province. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. It comes as U.S. troops are set to withdraw by September 11th. Back in this country, Florida's state legislature has approved a bill that curbs voting by mail and limits the use of drop boxes. Republicans say the legislation will help prevent fraud, but Democrats argue it restricts voting rights. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign it into law. European Union regulators are accusing Apple of violating the bloc's antitrust rules. They allege that the tech giant distorts competition for music streaming services in their favor through their app store. Apple rejected the claims. The European economy has fallen back into recession amid a pandemic lockdowns and slower COVID vaccine rollouts. Economic output shrank 0.6% in the first 3 months of the year in the 19 countries that use the euro. But most economists say they believe an upturn is on the way as inoculations ramp up in coming weeks. And stocks gave up ground on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 185 points to close at 33,875. The Nasdaq fell 120 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 30. Still to come on the NewsHour, a frontline look at the struggle to vaccinate a skeptical public. How forced labor in China creates an economic fight. Catching massive waves in a new documentary on a female surfer, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Daily COVID vaccinations here in the U.S. have been dropping in recent weeks. It comes as more than half of all adults in the country have received at least one shot. William Brangham explores the complexities behind this decrease in demand and what it will take to get more Americans vaccinated.
Judy, we know all adults in the U.S. are now eligible for the vaccine, but as you said, the pace of vaccinations has dropped. We're now at about 2.5 million shots each day. In fact, some jurisdictions are declining new vaccine shipments because they say they have too much on hand and not enough arms to put them in. So what is driving this? Is it hesitancy, outright opposition, or more of a wait-and-see approach? Dr. Philip Kaiser is one of the many public health officials trying to figure that out. He runs the local health authority in Galveston, Texas, which is right on the Gulf Coast. Dr. Kaiser, very good to have you on the NewsHour. Thank you for being here. My understanding is that you are at about 40% of adults fully vaccinated, which is pretty good in your county. I mean, it's better than the national average, but the demand has really slowed. When did that slowdown occur?
We started seeing it about three and a half weeks ago. We actually have about 50% of people having at least one shot in arms. And we knew that when we got to that level, based on some surveys that we'd done, that we'd start seeing people that were hesitant to get the vaccine. What really surprised us was the rapidity at which it dropped off. It dropped off very dramatically within the past 2 weeks.
Every armchair epidemiologist in the country has a theory as to why demand has dropped off. You're an actual infectious disease specialist who's working on the front lines. What is your sense? Why has demand fallen off?
I think there's a different story for every person who doesn't want to do it. And, you know, we've heard that it's white evangelicals. We've heard it's African Americans who are feeling alienated. We've heard that it is poor people. We've heard that it may be people that are primarily Spanish speaking. And I got to tell you, it's all of those things plus more, including the convenience of getting the vaccine. There's a perception that where we were doing our mass vaccine testing was far away. We're seeing that some people just don't have the time. They feel like they can't get off from work. We're seeing some people don't have a sense of that they really need it. But I think the biggest thing really is the issue of trust. There's a lot of distrust coming from all sides. And there's distrust of the vaccine, the approval process, and distrust of the public health officials that are encouraging people to get vaccinated.
I understand you're one of the jurisdictions that told the state, don't send us any more big batches because we've got enough on our hands now. Do you have an extra supply of vaccine now? And if so, what are you doing with that?
Well, we do have an extra supply, and right now we're holding it in our freezers. We've gone from using 20,000 doses a week down to about 2,000 doses a week. But we do think that we may have an increased demand for it as approval for school-aged children comes out, which probably may be in several weeks or within a month. And so we want to make sure we have enough on hand that as parents want to get their children vaccinated to go back to school, that we have that with us as well. So we're watching and waiting. We're counting our numbers very carefully. We're also taking account of the expiration dates on some of these vaccines, because some of them we have to use before August 30th or else they go bad. So it's really become a real dance in trying to figure out what the right amount to order is and watching how rapidly we're using it.
Sounds like you have to be doing a ton of public education left and right every time you go out trying to encourage people.
Yeah, no, it really is. And, you know, I think in retrospect, what we're going to say is that the first 50% were easy. And I think the next 25% are, and that's that group of people that are saying they're not sure, is going to be a lot harder. So what we're doing is we're working with communities, we're working with churches, we're working at community centers, we're working with restaurant associations, we're working with large employers, just going out to where they are and offering people vaccine. But we're finding that we even need to reach out more. Even yesterday, we did an event at one of the large hotels here in Galveston, and the vaccinators stopped to get lunch on the way back, and they had a few extra, and they asked people in the restaurant, do you want a vaccine? And some people said, oh, yeah, I think I would. And so I think that's what we're going to be have to doing. We're going to have to be going out where people are to find those people who want it or are unsure, but are not really anxious to get it, and make it easy for them and be available to answer questions for them so they can feel comfortable.
So it sounds like this sort of age old phrase in public health, meet people where they are, make it as simple and smooth and as easy as possible, regardless of who they are and where they come from. Do you think that's going to be enough?
I'm hopeful that it'll be enough to get us to the point where we have herd immunity. We know that there are some people that are hard-nosed. They just don't want it. And I think that's going to be okay. Because if we can get that 25% of folks that are thinking about it, unsure, we'll be around 75% vaccinated. And that's kind of the consensus number. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult. So instead of doing thousands of people in a single day, we did as many as 5,000 in a day. We'll be doing hundreds of people at smaller events where we only have a few score of people actually coming up to get the vaccine. And it's just going to take time.
All right, Dr. Philip Kaiser, Galveston County Department of Health. Thank you very much and good luck with your work.
All right, thank you very much.
There is a dark side to the so-called Belt and Road program. China's massive undertaking for global development rests on forced labor. And a new report today details the pattern of abuse. The West accuses Beijing of exploiting ethnic minority Uyghurs to produce cotton. Nick Schifrin reports how that Western criticism sparked a nationalist backlash in China, directed at Western companies.
On Chinese social media, patriotism requires punishing perceived enemies. Last month, that enemy was Swedish department store H&M. A popular blogger ripped up what she called her last H&M blouse. And H&M's flagship in Beijing disappeared from Chinese mapping and e-commerce sites. On Chinese TV, aspiring pop stars were feeling good because their Adidas shirts were blurred after that company faced a boycott. And pro-Beijing lawmakers in Hong Kong looked lovingly for the last time at their Burberry scarves, also boycotted. Yes. In their place, Chinese blogger O Wang Xiaoming told her million followers to buy Chinese.
Take advantage of this opportunity to give our domestic goods a chance. We'll confirm that no one in no country can order us around.
The boycott was launched when China's Communist Youth League criticized H&M and other companies for last year's statements expressing concern that cotton from China's Xinjiang region was produced by forced labor. 80% of Chinese cotton comes from Xinjiang. The U.S. and Europe say that Uyghurs involved in the process are forced into that labor, and they accuse Beijing of genocide against the Uyghur people.
With regard to the Uyghurs.
2 days before the boycotts, the U.S. and Europe launched coordinated sanctions.
We need to be able to bring the world together in speaking with one voice in condemning what has taken place and what continues to take place.
Beijing denies Western accusations. The Communist Youth League post read, "Spreading rumors to boycott Xinjiang cotton while trying to make money in China? Wishful thinking." Beijing's backers bragged about Xinjiang cotton on the runway during China Fashion Week and stoked by Chinese state media. This was reported live from Xinjiang.
So Michelle, you can see, you know, with us is a very prosperous Atikan Square. And this is exactly what is happening in Kashgar. There's definitely no genocide, so to speak. So Michelle, back to you.
Nationalism has become the new ideology in China.
Zheng Wang is a professor at Seton Hall's School of Diplomacy and International Relations. He says Chinese influencers risk losing support if they don't reflect demands to be patriotic. Actress Victoria Song dropped her H&M endorsement, saying national interests are above all else.
No people, they want to be a target of the internet nationalism. So they don't want to be being blamed for not patriotic enough.
But the boycott also reflects a more assertive Beijing. Under Xi Jinping, China is more willing to require companies to follow its rules and to claim Western hypocrisy. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hua Chunying.
This is a picture from the U.S. when black slaves were forced to pick cotton in the fields. And this is a picture of Xinjiang's cotton field. The accusation of so-called forced labor in Xinjiang does not exist.
And it does represent a tipping point. And some of it has to do with the particular issue of Xinjiang and the Uyghurs and the way that's being viewed in the West. But I think it also has to do with broader dynamics in terms of China's changing relationship with the West.
Michael Herson is the China practice head for the Eurasia Group and the former U.S. Treasury chief representative in Beijing. He says Western companies operating in China are caught between Beijing's demands for silence and Western demands to avoid forced labor.
They're facing two-way political risk right now. They're under pressure from home governments and stakeholders like NGOs to speak out on some of these values issues related to China. And then, of course, in China's market, they're under pressure from the government and also bottom-up pressure from Chinese citizens who are inclined to partake in consumer boyCotts.
China has more middle-class potential consumers than the U.S. has population, and it remains the world's manufacturing leader. Many companies are bending to Beijing's pressure. By the end of last month, H&M China says it does not represent any political position and is committed to long-term investment and development in China. And its headquarters posted a statement saying it hoped to regain the trust of its Chinese consumers.
For a lot of Western companies, the China market is both too large and the political blowback in China is too acute. Many companies, if push comes to shove, are going to try to stay in the China market and will probably risk a Western blowback over a blowback in China.
But the U.S. is trying to exert its own pressure. Customs and Border Protection are now conducting checks like this one of ships arriving in the U.S. with Xinjiang cotton and tomatoes. The Trump administration passed a regional ban. The Biden administration is implementing it.
We've been working very hard to protect, protect the American people, protect American businesses, and ensure that goods produced in whole and part with forced labor are not entering our market.
Anna Inahosa is a Customs and Border Protection Executive Director. She says since an initial ban on Xinjiang cotton in December, CBP has detained over 300 shipments to ensure they carried no cotton produced with Xinjiang forced labor. An additional 200 shipments turned around before they could be checked.
We have received very clear signals that this is just as much of a priority to this administration as it was to the previous administration. I think President Biden has been very clear that the issue of forced labor is something that is part of his trade agenda.
But it's not easy to know whether cotton is from Xinjiang or was made with forced labor. China mixes domestic and imported cotton and blocks companies from independent investigations. So CBP is working on new tracing technology.
There's no silver bullet, but we are optimistic that there are some really good technologies that are helping answer some of those questions and hopefully making things a little bit easier for businesses to stay compliant.
In the meantime, Beijing will demand compliance to its rules. And while the West will object to Chinese human rights violations, there's little evidence that Beijing is willing to listen. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Years of marriage to the late Senator John McCain gave Cindy McCain a front row seat to the adventure and challenges of life in politics. From navigating political scandals and a growing family to taking on President Trump, she writes about it all and more in her new book, Stronger: Courage, Hope, and Humor in My Life with John McCain. And Cindy McCain joins me now. Welcome to the NewsHour. Very good to have you with us. We're so glad to have you. So you do write Cindy McCain, and we hope to get that picture back from Skype. We're working on that. I hope you're still there. If she is, we will continue.
I can't. I'm so sorry. Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
There you are. We're gonna.
Calling. I apologize.
It's all good. We're gonna keep going. It's the way we all live right now. But Cindy McCain, you write about these 38 years, the ups, the downs, the highs, and the lows. There wasn't much of a quiet moment, was there?
No, there really wasn't. You know, in the very beginning, part of what we talked about was at some point that there'll be a normal in the household. There'll be a normal in our family. And of course, that never happened. It was always very exciting, always challenging, always a lot of fun. And of course, it had its pitfalls as well. And that's what I write about in my book.
I was glad that you were quite candid in the book, Cindy McCain, about the challenges for the spouse of a politician. It's usually been a woman, second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff notwithstanding. And women, as you write so much through the book, often don't have the self-confidence that they should have.
Well, that was very much the case with me. I lived in fear of making a mistake that would somehow humiliate my husband or the state of Arizona. You know, these were all certainly important things, but it was also, this was undue pressure I put on myself. And so as the years went on and I made my harsh mistakes along the way, I began to understand myself a little more and realize that it's okay to make mistakes. And it is okay to certainly learn from them and move on. Nobody's perfect. And that was something I really had to learn.
And you encountered snide comments from the wives of other politicians, even from then First Lady Nancy Reagan, ugly remarks about your daughter, Bridget. It was pretty tough.
Well, it was, yes, it was. In the case of my daughter, Bridget, John and I always knew that he and I were fair game in any of these races, especially the presidential ones. But for a campaign to take out against my daughter, Bridget McCain, was just unconscionable. And they did. And some years later, when she Googled herself on the internet, found out what had happened and came to me crying, asking me, and I mean this just as a factual thing, she came to me crying and asking why the president hated her. It took me a long time to make her understand that this wasn't personal, it was all about politics. But I'm not sure she's really over it, though, to be honest with you. And she's almost 30.
That's really, really hard to hear. And Cindy McCain, you're very clear about who your husband's friends were and who some of them were not. Sarah Palin, who he chose as his vice presidential running mate, you write that she never contacted him in the many months that he was sick leading up to his death. And you go on to say toward the end of the book that you think she cost him the presidential election in 2008.
Well, I think there were many parts to that. And I believe in the book, but I will say also, you know, the bottom fell out of the market. I mean, things were cascading, as we know, the fallout that occurred. I think everything was doubled. Like everyone, of course, wanted the very best for my husband. And I believed that everyone around him should be the best. And so for me, it was just about really protecting my husband and protecting our legacy and protecting my family that this was all about. And, you know, in years since, I think we've all managed to always hindsight's, you know, 2020, and yeah. We all have different views of things, but for my family and for everything, I know that my husband ran a great race and I knew he tried his best, and that's all that counts.
One of the people you write about who was not a friend of your husband, former President Trump, who said unkind things about your husband even after his death. What is your view right now of Donald Trump?
I don't think much about it. I really don't. My view has been about the progress that President Biden has made, and also where we go as a nation now. We now have an opportunity to work together with civility, with kindness, with generosity, in a bipartisan fashion for the good of the country. What we need to learn now is we can work together, we can disagree, we can fight like heck, but it's not personal. It comes down to what's good for the country, and that's what I see happening now. And I see good things, and I'm very hopeful for the future.
And in connection with that, you've been very public. You did vote for Joe Biden for president. You also say that you're a lifelong Republican. So I want to ask you, how do you explain the great loyalty that former President Trump still has among so many Republicans?
You know, I really can't, other than people have their beliefs and what they believe to be true and what's not true. And I just disagree. I think President Biden is a remarkable president and will be he's such a healer for this country. After what we observed on January 6th, there was only one way to go, and that was up, and that was by electing Joe Biden, as you know. So in my opinion, where we're at now and what the opportunities that we have as Americans to repair both of our parties. Both of our parties are damaged, and I'm not criticizing either side, but both parties need to remember what's right, and that is working together for the good of the country.
I'm asking you about Republicans supporting former President Trump, in part because a group of his loyalists are paying for, as you know, an audit of the presidential votes in Arizona's most populous county. It's an unprecedented thing. What happens if they come back and say President Trump won and therefore he won the state?
You know, that particular audit has happened, what, 4 or 5 times now in the course since the election. President Biden won. He won the election. Our governor said so. It went on to be ratified by the United States of America. I'm sorry there are a few people that disagree with this, but life goes on, and it's time that we work together for our country, for the good of the country and for the good of the people that they represent.
I do want to ask you, but you've mentioned President Biden a few times, and I do want to ask you about some of what he's proposing right now. You've raised 4 children, and you've spoken a great deal about the importance of family. He wants to spend an unprecedented amount of money, in his words, strengthening the American family, $1 trillion on everything from more education to child care to paid family leave in order to allow women, more women to go back into the workforce. What's your thinking about that?
Well, I'm a lifelong Republican, and I have remained a Republican. And I knew when I endorsed Joe Biden that I would not agree with him on everything. And so there are many things coming up that I do not agree on, but I'm willing to, as most Americans are, to sit back, listen, and watch the Congress act as it should in a civil way to find what's best for the country. I'm not an elected official. I can only tell you what I think. And I disagree, but I'm willing to listen and willing to pay attention to what's going on.
So it sounds like you have some skepticism about these, that proposal.
No, not skepticism. I don't agree with all elements of it. I'm not skeptical of anything that President Biden would propose. But I am, again, I want to make sure that everyone understands I am a Republican. And so I do have differences, but I believe in the good nature and the ability for President Biden to work across the aisle.
Last thing I want to ask you about, as you know, there are very reliable news reports that President Biden is planning to name you to be the U.S. ambassador to the World Food Program. We know, Cindy McCain, you've had a longtime interest in human trafficking. What would you be able to do in a position like this?
Well, first of all, I can't talk about any of that, but in any position that I would be lucky enough to be enabled to do, I would, of course, work on human trafficking. The elements that occur around this world, and you just had a report on about what was going on in China, are the exact reason we need to focus on human rights and human trafficking around the world. It is most important that we give a voice to the voiceless around the world and rescue these folks from what is the element of the most human indecency possible.
Cindy McCain is out with a new book. It's titled Stronger, Courage, Hope, and Humor in My Life with John McCain. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And now we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you on this Friday, and I have to start by asking you each just for a thought on what Cindy McCain had to say. Jonathan Capehart, she says she's a lifelong Republican, but clearly some distance there with President Trump.
Right. And I'm glad she made the point that, yes, she did vote for President Biden. She endorsed him in the presidential campaign, but that she's staying within the party. She is not giving up her party to the folks who have taken it over, and most definitely not giving up her party to President Trump. And the through line through everything that she said was, what's good for the country? How can we talk about these issues civilly? We can disagree with each other, but not disagree with each other so much so that we don't see each other as human beings. That is the brand of the Republican Party that I wish would come back. If that brand of the Republican Party were to come back, imagine how much could get done in Washington.
And David, how tough is it to have that position as a Republican right now?
There's a dwindling herd of dwindling men, but no, they're out there. You know, I want to talk about one thing she said earlier about the lack of self-confidence. The most exciting political campaign, maybe along with Barack Obama's 08 campaign, that I've ever covered was the John McCain 2000 campaign. And we were really embedded in the campaign. And I recall Cindy McCain at those events at the meet and greets. You could see the dread, the lack of self-confidence, the lack of comfort with being in public. And she wouldn't remember me, but we would occasionally talk just to pass the time so there wouldn't be a public performance. And then that McCain campaign took off in New Hampshire, and it was really down to South Carolina where Bush and McCain were going at each other. And I remember she was on stage with McCain when the first allegations about their daughter came out. Mm-hmm. And you can see the look of shock and horror on her face. And I think it was partly out of that umbrage. But then as years went by, and then when he ran for president again, you saw a Cindy McCain who was strong, extremely comfortable in the campaign. And when I saw her, covered her later in the years, I was really struck by the dramatic progress she had made in just being a political and public person. And as she said, deciding she wasn't going to be ruled by fear.
And so striking to hear her say that the pain caused for her daughter Bridget is still there. She thinks that so hard to hear. Jonathan, the big political event of the week, President Biden's speech to the joint session of Congress, 27 million Americans watched it. Now that it's been a few days, what stays with you from that?
What stays with me, Judy, is what I told you Wednesday night. The idea that we have a president of the United States who speaks to the country, doesn't go on about grievance, doesn't go on about personal grievance, doesn't sprinkle his speech with white nationalism, isn't all me, 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 me. What we saw on Wednesday night was a president of the United States who was focused outward. Many times in his speech, because of you, meaning the American people, because of all of you, the folks in the room. It was about working together, solving the country's problems, or at least trying to. And that, for me, is the enduring image. And also, you got the sense that even with the sparse crowd in that room that could hold 1,600, but there were only 200 and socially distanced, at least for me, watching on television, there was still that energy there. There was still this optimism coming from President Biden, who after, at that point, 99 days, had accomplished a lot.
And David, 2 days later, what is your takeaway?
I think first, you know, the Democratic Party does well when it's a working class party, and it does poorly when it's the party of affluent people in coastal cities. And Biden really focuses it on the working class. And it's really a working class agenda. I think that's just very positive. Second, there's just an implied diagnosis of where the country is. The implied diagnosis is that there's serious structural problems in the country, inequalities, social fragmentation, social distrust, and that the country needs a once-in-a-generation investment if it's going to re-energize itself, and if it's going to keep up with an autocratic threat from now a global rival. And so, you know, where you feel about the Biden agenda, whether you have reservations about pieces of it, will depend on whether you buy that basic diagnosis of where we are. And I have to say, you look at the deaths of despair, the rising inequality, the Zoom China now has, I have to say that's a pretty compelling diagnosis of, I think, where the country is.
Jonathan, is President Biden reading the country correctly?
I think he is. I mean, David is right. We are facing problems in this country that if we don't get moving on solving them, not only are we going to get left behind at home, but China is just going to run away with everything. And the president made a point of talking about that, that there's a choice here. Democracy versus autocracy. Democracy has to show that it works, that it can get things done. But this is also a competition between the United States and China. If we do not do something about broadband, our electrical grid, making sure that people who want to work can actually go out and work and don't have to worry about childcare or family leave, that if we're not able to do those things, we're going to lose the future to China.
And I mean, picking up on that, David, I mean, it is an ambitious set of plans President Biden is talking about. What is it, $4 trillion between just the two latest, if you add that to the couple of trillion in the American Rescue Plan. But he is talking about some major issues. I raised some of them with Cindy McCain, child care assistance, paid family leave, direct subsidies to family, lower-income families. In fact, you've written about this today. And the question is this something the federal government needs to be doing?
I think so. Pretty much every other advanced democracy does it. And we've seen the strain on parenting, the strain on American families. We've been in a period of family decay for a long time, in part caused by the pressures of the market, in part caused by a culture of individualism and a culture that puts work over family. And in part, just lack of money. There's just so much economic stress that leads to family problems. And so I think spending money is called for. People want to have a secure family where they can raise their kids without having to move, without the financial stress. There are a lot of pieces to the Biden plan. I think some of them are fantastic. The child tax credit, that gives you a lot of money that you can, if you want to spend it on daycare, you can do that. If you feel like you want to stay home, you can cut back to part-time and stay home. And so that gives parents ultimate control. I think the family leave is very important because it shows that we're a culture that puts family over work. Other parts I'm less comfortable with. I'm for Head Start, but you can pour a lot of money into Head Start without a lot of results. It's a program that needs to be reformed. As for the child care, I would love to see that money that goes to the child care piece put into the child tax credit so the parents who want child care can choose it. I don't think the administration should be in the business of trying to move people into jobs and get parents working. And Jonathan and I were told by a White House official this week that our part of our purpose is to get people into parents into jobs. And that, to me, is up to parents. And government should be totally neutral on what kind of family people want to form.
Jonathan, where are you coming down on that?
Well, I hear you, David, but I'm going to have to disagree with you on this. I don't think the Biden administration or President Biden is trying to tell the American people what kinds of families they should have. I think these plans and proposals are meeting American families where they are. A lot of families might want to, folks and families want to work, but they can't because they can't afford childcare. Folks want to go out and keep their jobs, but they can't because there's an ailing parent or a spouse has given birth or adopted a child. And those kinds of pressures on the American family, when we hear people talk about the reasons why they don't work or take the third or fourth job, it has to do with, to David's point, lack of money, but also it has to do with childcare, not being able to take time off to care for a dying parent, all sorts of things that have been plaguing the American worker. President Biden is now saying, okay, I'm focused on how do we get American workers back into the workforce because they want to work.
And David, you're welcome to comment on that. And I want to ask both of you about 100 days in, is this a president who seems to be heading to some kind of success or not?
First, quickly on the child care thing, getting parents out of the workforce is good for the economy. It's better for the economy than not. That's for sure. But what's better for kids? If you look at the money that's been spent around the world, the money spent on child direct payments to parents produces better educational gains than any other kind of spending. So I think we should do that. I'm also worried that it's going to look like a bunch of upper middle class people who like dual income in families is imposing a set of values on working class people on both who don't. Quickly on the 100 days, a lot of people compare it to the New Deal. To me, it's comparable to the American system. And for those of you with long memories, the American system was a 19th century set of policies, mostly sponsored by the Whig Party, led by Henry Clay. And it was a set of investments in infrastructure, in education, in human capital, built on the idea that America needed to invest to re-energize its greatness. And that the Whigs really used a lot of the language that Joe Biden uses today, and it's sort of Hamiltonian nationalist language. And I'm cheered because I think the Whig Party did a lot of good for this country, and that's why I have some faith in what Biden is doing.
Jonathan?
I think the first 100 days of the Biden presidency have been a success. I think maybe the next 50 to 100 days could be a success. But whether the rest of the term is a success really depends on the Republicans and how much they want to actually work with President Biden to actually solve problems. There's too much of a competition mindset here in Washington that to do something, to allow President Biden to actually sign legislation into law is a victory for him and a loss for us, meaning Republicans, as opposed to a victory for the country. And the other thing is what will determine whether President Biden is a success is whether Republicans decide to come to the table with real ideas, actual ideas, that they can debate and discuss with the president and compromise with the president to actually get something done.
Zero-sum game or something where the two sides can sit down and talk to each other. A lot to think about on this Friday night. We thank you both, Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we do at the end of every week, we take a moment now to honor some of the extraordinary lives that have been lost to the pandemic. It didn't matter if he was singing rock, blues, or country. Dave Robinette was most in his element when he was on stage. The 67-year-old musician gravitated to the guitar early in life. He played gigs all over the western U.S. and eventually got to perform one of his original songs at the Grand Ole Opry. Dave met the love of his life, Timelyn, after one of his shows. She plans on seeing through a project that Dave was close to finishing when he died, a 12-track album of his original songs. 70-year-old Charlie Nyamkul was a charismatic presence wherever he went, and it was part of what made the restaurants he owned so popular, his daughter said. He left Thailand for the U.S. in the 1970s. Eventually, he and his wife launched restaurants of their own in Manhattan and Atlanta. Charlie's warmth made it easy to build a rapport with colleagues and guests, and many became friends for life. He cherished his time with family and, above all, wanted to be a role model for his grandkids. Cheryl Gorman was always on the move, her friends and family said. She was the kind of person who would always bring joy into the room. Cheryl was well known in her Louisiana community as the captain of the long-running all-women crew of ISIS, one of the many teams that organize Mardi Gras celebrations. But the 56-year-old was just as well known for her generous spirit. One lifelong friend said that whenever she met someone new, she never left a stranger. Those closest to Rob Malone described him as selfless and relentlessly positive. A sports standout during high school, Rob became a much-loved coach within his Minnesota youth sports community. It was because he put genuine care for the players above all else, his daughter said. He was quick to help neighbors and brought joy to so much of what he did, whether it was watching his own children excel or playing around with them during his spare time. Rob Malone was 54. Greg Kelly would never turn down the opportunity to help somebody, his daughter said. The lifelong Idahoan volunteered within the Mormon Church and as a ski patroller monitoring local trails. The 68-year-old also relished big tasks and big adventures. He summited the Grand Teton Peak twice and with his family built a cabin in the woods that they all could enjoy. They said he did what he could to pass on his love of adventure and the out of doors. And we so appreciate families for sharing these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. And finally tonight, a look inside the world of elite big wave surfers and one of the few women in the world who take on the monster waves and her fears. Stephanie Tsai has the story. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
This is Nazaré, Portugal, home to the biggest surfable waves on the planet. So big that surfers have to be towed in with jet skis. So big that the 50 to 100 foot walls of water can slam surfers to the ocean floor. The big wave surfing world descends here every fall and winter, even during a worldwide pandemic. Like many extreme sports, big wave surfing is male dominated. Portuguese surfer Joana Andrade is one of a handful of women trying to change that.
So in the beginning it was not easy, and sometimes it's not easy too. They look to us and say, maybe you are not able to surf, maybe it's too big, are you sure you want to go? But I think it's changing.
Andrade is the subject of the documentary Big Versus Small, in part a nod to her height, 5'1".
Does it make it harder being someone on the shorter side surfing these big waves?
Some people don't know me and they look, you are Joana Andrade, but you are so small and you surf these waves. My strength not come from my body, but yes, from my mind and from my heart.
I love that. Your strength comes from your heart and your mind.
The sheer size of the waves was what intrigued the film's director, Finnish filmmaker Minna Dufton. And in the interest of research, she learned to surf, albeit on smaller waves.
A lot of the film is about big feelings. Mm-hmm. And how to conquer them. Is that what you were going for with the title, Big Versus Small?
Joana
is tiny and the wave is rather huge. And I've always been drawn to opposites. And, you know, I found it so interesting how, you know, to figure out what is big and what is small in us humans.
The story is as much about surfing as it is about the mental strength and mindset it takes to conquer these waves, particularly when you have a profound fear of drowning, as Andra does.
Of course, I'm afraid to drown. But I keep going there because I want to know why I'm so afraid to drown.
Oh, so you're trying to explore your fear through surfing.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to know just a woman that could help and that could help Joanna face her fear of drowning.
Oh my God.
This is going to be our swimming pool today.
Johanna Nordblad is one of the world's best free divers, divers who plunge into watery depths without supplemental oxygen, using only their own lung capacity.
You go first.
She used an icy winter lake in Finland to teach Andrade how to control her breathing to stave off panic. Nordblad spoke to us from Helsinki.
The holding your breath, it's the similar feeling like the cold. It's very intensive, it's very big. But when you are under the wave, you have to relax because if you relax, you don't use the oxygen and then you have more time.
Dufton herself faced both literal and metaphorical waves in making this film. First, there was Mother Nature.
I don't think I've ever been as nervous as a director to see my crew all out there in jet skis and, you know, Joanna surfing. And those waves, they are pretty tight one after another. They don't really leave that many opportunities for us as a film crew to capture the shot that we want.
Another big wave she faced, funding.
The equity issue that you bring up with big wave surfing and women is probably also something you can relate to as a female documentary filmmaker, right?
You know, big wave surfing and independent filmmaking is fraught with doubt, you know, uncertainty about where the money is going to come from and rejection. I mean, Joanna Andrade, for example, she is a non-sponsored athlete in that sport. And I'm an equivalent filmmaker.
Well, I'm sure during the pandemic, there are a lot of people facing big waves.
You know, Joanna's story is you know, a really good example of is overcoming your biggest fears. And I really hope it helps people overcome their fears and whatever big waves that they're facing in their lives.
Big versus Small is viewable online and in person at the Docklands Film Festival in California and the Illuminate Festival in Sedona, Arizona in May. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Such an inspiration. So glad to hear that story. Thank you, Stephanie. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, please stay safe, have a good weekend. Thank you and good night.